welcome to another episode of Microsoft Developer Radio. I'm one of your hosts today. My name is Peter Ladotti, and I'm a technology evangelist at Microsoft. And joining me today from beautiful North Carolina is Mr. Brian Hitney. Hey, Brian, how's it going?
Hey, Peter, how you doing? I was just thinking that today it's not very beautiful here in North Carolina. It's a little bit drizzly, so I guess Seattle follows me around. But enjoying the spring weather, and we have a lot to talk about today, right? Because what we're doing is we're going to take a little bit of a break. We have Andrew coming back for yet more of what he's been doing with Windows Azure and integrating that into his Windows 8 applications. But there's been a number of announcements lately. I guess by the time you're watching this, it'll be at least a few days, but that for us just happened yesterday. So it's some pretty exciting stuff. Peter,
You mentioned the spring weather, and you know it seems that the Windows Azure team in their 4 or 5 year existence have been following this pattern of having spring and fall releases or new features that just roll out. It's the cloud. It's not like there's a major release, but it sort of is. And so the spring set of features showed up this past week or so, and there were a couple of announcements. One was around the availability of infrastructure as a service. So in Windows Azure, we've got several different mechanisms available to you to host your applications, whether they be in a virtual machine that you set up and manage, whether it's in a cloud service where it's a virtual machine that's allocated for you that Windows Azure manages, or if you just want to publish a website in a multi-tenant environment. And the ability to host your own virtual machine, which we refer to as infrastructure as a service, has been in preview for, sounds like eons now, over a year or so?
Yeah, I remember we were talking about that even at TechEd last year, right? So that was at least a year.
Yeah, so after that long incubation period, it is now official. Like, you can use VMs and have all the full SLA behind it in terms of if it crashes, we'll pay you or something like that. But there's a lot of neat things that came along with that, and it really opens up the opportunities for whole new sets of application types that you can run in the cloud as a whole. So a lot of these announcements we track through Scott Guthrie, who is one of the main bigwigs on the Windows Azure team. He kind of oversees the whole thing, at least the developer experience for folks using Azure. And he's got a great post that lists out all the details in terms of what is new and different in terms of infrastructure as a service as it became generally available, not out of the beta label. So maybe we should go take a look at that. But Brian, I think one of the most interesting things in there, the one that catches the headlines, is pricing. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did. So, in fact, I think it's one of the things that I find always really compelling about cloud is really just the economics behind it. It's so consumer friendly and favorable because you have all these cloud vendors who are essentially competing for each other, and the economics of building out data centers at massive scale like Microsoft and Google and Amazon and so on, those cost savings that can be included in there for consumers is just so great that it almost makes it impossible for you to build something cheaper yourself, even, for a large project. So it's really
exciting. So let me get this straight. So part of these new updates to make it consumer friendly, like my mom can just go roll in and roll her own data center? Is that what you're talking about? Like, in terms of consumers, the average Joe's going to use this stuff?
Well, okay, maybe not the average Joe. Maybe there's not consumer stuff that is necessarily easy for somebody to use. But then again, software as a service is all about building applications that can be easily consumed in the cloud. So I think,
we should really define what we mean, the context for consumer in this case.
Okay, consumer maybe would be anybody technical who's watching this. How about that? The consumer of somebody who needs cloud or technology services, not your mom or your Aunt Betty. How about that? We'll define that. But technology in general.
I had to bring Aunt Betty into this.
Yeah, I had to bring Aunt Betty into this. But it's really exciting to see. So the pricing is pretty competitive. An extra small instance, which has the virtual cores are shared, it starts at just 2 cents an hour, which is really inexpensive. So you could build out a completely custom VM or use one from the gallery that has, you know, the predefined components and so on. And 2 cents an hour is really, I mean, I can afford that. I don't know. That's really inexpensive. So it ends up being what about
15 bucks a month?
Yeah, $15 a month, right? So that's pretty inexpensive. And then obviously it goes up from there as you add more cores. I think as of right now, the small is 9 cents, and then the medium, which is a 2-core, goes up to 18 cents, and it goes up a little bit from there. But it's the pricing is always coming down, which is really exciting to see. So
like Walmart, our prices are always dropping. You know, another interesting thing about it in these VM sizes, and they come in different shapes and sizes in terms of the number of core CPU cores that are allocated and the memory, the bandwidth that are associated. They did a couple of things. They added two new virtual machine sizes. So it used to be, you know, like McDonald's, extra small, small, medium, large, extra large. Well, now there's like triple XL and quadruple XL, except they don't call it that. They call it the A6 and the A7, which sounds so I don't know. It doesn't make me feel like I've got a really big honking machine, but it's still, The largest I previously had an 8-core CPU with 14 gigs of RAM, and the one below that was 4 cores with 7 gigs. So now these new two sizes, they don't increase the cores. You basically, this A6 and A7 size have 4 cores and 8 cores respectively, but the memory is like doubled. So it goes, the A6 is 4 cores with 28 gigs of RAM, and the A7 is 8 cores with 56 gigs of RAM. Which, if you think about, what does that let you do? It lets you run some of the big, powerful server applications that Microsoft has, which is the other thing that was interesting about this announcement. If you're using infrastructure as a service where you can create the VM and manage it on your own, we give you these templates that install a lot of Microsoft stuff like SharePoint Server and BizTalk and things like that, or SQL Server, you know, gives you the pre-configured machine right out of the get-go. You kind of build it up like a recipe. And, you know, with that type of hardware behind it, it makes it possible to easily set up, you know, a set of servers running that type of software.
Yeah, it's exciting to see. In fact, the A7, I'm looking at that pricing right now. Maybe that one pricing isn't so consumer-friendly, but the A7 that has the 8 cores and 56 gig of RAM is $2.04 an hour, which is about $1,500 a month. So maybe not something I would be rolling out, but if you do think about the business need, if you need that type of horsepower and that type of RAM, if you're doing a lot of big data or data crunching, having the high memory availability of some of those virtual machines can be really crucial for a business need. So,
well, it's cool to see that. You say it's not consumer friendly, but I beg to differ because remember, let's define the context of what we mean by a consumer. We're not talking about Aunt Betty. We're talking about someone who's managing an IT shop, who's running applications and deploying them in a data center today. $1,500 a month, if that's what, is that the math for $2 a month, or $2 an hour?
Yeah, $2 an hour, yeah.
So I mean, let's just say it's in that ballpark. You know, that sounds like, whoa, that's a lot of money to run my blog. Well, we're not talking about running your blog. We're talking about, you know, a corporate app or, you know, some big, you know, internet site backbone. Where, you know, maybe if you were running your own data center and running your own servers, you'd probably be paying a lot more than $1,500 a month.
Yeah, it's that amount of RAM that really jacks up the pricing, right? I mean, 56 gig of RAM is a lot of RAM, you know? So under normal circumstances for our typical, you know, I'm thinking general web applications and enterprise applications, typically you don't need that much RAM. So, again, these are very special use case scenarios, but it's still cool to see that we have it.
Now, there's also, you know, one of the big things, I remember when infrastructure as a service was first announced a year or so ago that raised a lot of eyebrows, is that not only do we let you run Linux or Windows virtual machines, we let you run Linux virtual machines, which people are like, Microsoft? Linux? Really? Wow. So, you can, and you can do that at all the same hardware sizes, and you actually pick up a little bit of a discount because in the Windows VMs, the licensing for the Windows OS is built into the price. So if you look at a Linux VM, they're on average, you know, a couple of cents cheaper per hour if you look at the price chart available in Azure there. And likewise, just like with the Windows VMs where there's a bunch of templated VMs, you know, maybe I want to install SQL Server or, you know, install Windows running something else, there's a bunch of templates for Linux where you can install that with certain things on top of it too. to give you some good, you know, starting points for getting your applications running, and also support for multiple versions of Linux. I believe we have OpenSUSE, Ubuntu, and CentOS, I think is the other one we support, or a couple flavors of that. And, you know, that really makes it interesting. We'll talk about this as we get into the developer aspect of this. By running a Linux VM, it really opens Azure up to a lot of non-Microsoft technologies. And I say that lightly because Azure has really supported non-Microsoft developer technologies since the get-go in terms of, you know, not being just a .NET cloud play. You could do PHP and Java and whatever have you. But, you know, some of the other developer platforms or technologies like Python or Ruby and things like that were really, let's just say, not easy to do. And now that you can run a Linux VM, it's the same as running it anywhere else. It's just real easy. You say, hey, I want to do this, and it works. So it's really great to see the commitment to not just the .NET and Microsoft developer stack, but to pretty much any developer stack that's pretty much being used out there these days can be hosted in Azure quite easily now.
Yeah, you mentioned Ruby, and I don't want to put the cart before the horse, and maybe we'll get to this a little bit later on, but there's been a number of new announcements and SDK evolution with Ruby as well, right?
There have, but let's not put the cart before the horse. Let's
start with the
developer stuff.
All right, let's start with the demo. What we'll do is we'll show a quick look at some of the changes in Windows Azure websites. So what we'll do is we'll start by looking at Windows Azure websites, but specifically, let's take a step back, and it's not just infrastructure as a service and general availability, but there's an entire new Windows Azure SDK, and it just revved to version 2.0, so that's a big step. You know, we've been going from, 1.8 was the most recent one, I think, but, I mean, it feels like every couple of months it's another 1-point release, but to see it hit 2.0 just feels like it's an important release.
Yeah, there should be some really big stuff in here. So let's take a look at that.
Let's dissect this a little bit. So I've got Scott Guthrie's post up here that details everything that's in the new SDK really thoroughly. So one of the things that I think we'll start by doing is I'll just show you how Windows Azure has been incorporated a little bit more into Visual Studio. So I'm going to click over to my Windows Azure websites in the Windows Azure Management Portal. There's a whole lot of using the words Windows Azure in that sense. But so in here, I've got my Windows Azure websites. Now, Windows Azure websites is still in preview. And for those who don't know, the concept with Windows Azure websites is to make it very simple to host a website, either say Node.js or ASP.NET or PHP, very simply in the cloud without having to worry about propping up a VM or configuring anything. And so what you do is you gain a lot of ease of use while sacrificing some of the control you have over the environment, right? So it's that classic trade-off. But here, one of the things that we've done is we've integrated some of these controls that we can do for publishing in Visual Studio. So I've got three websites up. An empty demo site is the one I'm going to look at specifically. I just created one here. And if I open up Visual Studio and I just have a very simple MVC application, one of the things that we could do if I right-click on my application and go under Publish, you're going to see that we have a new publish web dialog here. So one of the things that we could do is very easily publish to our Windows Azure website directly from this dialog. So if I click on the import, for example, I can import directly from an existing Windows Azure website. And you can see that it will pull up the different Windows Azure websites that I happen to have. And if I select empty demo site, just for example, and click OK, it will automatically download my publish profile here, including all the credentials needed to publish directly. So we could have done this earlier. You can, without the SDK 2.0 prior to this, you could still deploy directly from Visual Studio, but you had to go through just the manual steps of downloading the published profile and integrating it into Visual Studio. So it's just a much friendlier solution here to do this. Now, one of the things that we still support, obviously, and one of the really cool ways you can publish as well, this would be a direct publish from this project right on my machine, but you can also publish directly from source control, which is a really great way to do it. You can use GitHub, you could use a different Git repository, Bitbucket, for example. You can also use TFS. And so if you've got a project that you're building, you can just check in your changes, and those changes will be continuously integrated and pushed out to your Windows Azure website. So that's pretty cool, too. And that's been there prior to 2.0, but this new publish dialog is brand new, and it's pretty great to see, just to make it much easier to publish your applications. One of the things that you can also do under the Server Explorer, if I open up my Windows Azure website, you'll see that I also can dive into each one. I can right-click on it, and we can look at the settings, for example, of that website. Now,
nice.
It is nice, yeah. And again, this is all information that was there in the portal before, but it's nice just to see that tighter integration with Visual Studio.
Yeah, so as a developer, I don't have to keep jumping back and forth to the browser. It's just really nice to have everything integrated like that in the tool set. I mean, it just shows how they've gone a long way to improving it and making it easier for developer using Visual Studio here.
Exactly. Okay, now the other thing that has changed a little bit is with cloud services. And so if I go back to the portal, and if I were to look at cloud services, and I have one here just called BTH test that I set up for this scenario. Now, one of the challenges has always been deploying web services quickly, and typically what you would do is if you had a true production environment is you could push something out.
You mean cloud services, right?
Cloud services, what did I say?
I think you said web services, but...
Web services, yeah, sorry. So with cloud services, the idea here is you push up your code. We have production and staging slots that make it easy to take code and move it from one environment to the other and make a nice seamless transition. Now, normally when you push your code up, we use a rolling update that basically takes down part of your deployment and moves the code over, keeps part of your website up and running while other parts of it are taken down and updated with the new code. And so one of the things that has changed with this, if we go back into Visual Studio, if I go into look at the publish settings here, for example, and I've already done this previously, so let me just go back to the previous screen. Now, a lot of this has been refactored a little bit. A lot of the same settings are still here about enabling remote desktop. But one of the things you could do is go into the advanced settings, and there's a bunch more options in here. One of them is deployment update, and if we click on settings, we can tell Windows Azure to skip doing the incremental update and rather do simultaneous updates, which would basically push out the entire website all at once, and your cloud service goes offline during that time, but it can be useful in a number of situations, particularly if you just want to get everything up and running very, very quickly and you don't necessarily care about the downtime. So a lot more options in here, just making it a lot friendlier for really just about any situation to get up and running.
Hey, Brian, I got a question. I noticed you're running Windows 8 there, right?
Yeah. Of course I'm running Windows 8. What kind of question is that?
But you got a start button over there. Are you running that new blue thing that everyone's talking about?
The start button is blue, yes. Am I running Windows Blue? No, I'm not. I'm still running Windows 8. I admit that I like having a start button. I'm using a classic start shell, and mainly because of the file grouping. I still like to dive in and see stuff in my folders as it gets installed, mainly for all the developer tools that we've got. So I admit
that. That makes you right.
What does that make me?
It makes you a class one Luddite.
Okay,
change. There was a start button there. It just had to hover over. It's like, oh, it's auto hidden. It's not auto hidden. No. Anyway.
Okay. Well, fair enough. I accept whatever labels I get from that. But the bottom line is, I enjoy having it there. I've worked with it both ways, and for me, I like it. So I'm comfortable with it. So
he doesn't like having his cheese moved, folks. It's okay.
No, that's okay.
We'll let you go.
Okay, so we're just about out of time for today, but were there any other major announcements or anything in Scott Guthrie's post we wanted to detail, Peter?
There are a couple of things. I just want to go through quickly. We won't have time to demo them, but it's definitely good to just make you aware of them, and then you can check them out on your own time. First off, there's the new .NET 2.0 SDK, right? That's something you have to install in your Visual Studio. So just a couple of notes from the fine print at the bottom of the post is that the SDK 2.0 can be run side by side with the two most recent versions of the Azure SDK. So you can run it side by side with 1.8 and 1.7 on your machine, but there's always a but, you cannot run it side by side with 1.6. I don't know why, I didn't make up this stuff, but that's the way it works. So if you're running Azure SDK 1.8 or 1.7, you're good to go. Install 2.0, run side by side, you're good there. Another couple things is I think the diagnostics and the storage DLLs that are part of the 2.0 SDK are now built on the newer version of the .NET framework. So you have to make sure you're targeting, I think, .NET 4.0 or above. So a couple little minor details there. You can find that in the post. But also related to this is just Azure in general, not just the 2.0 SDK. There's a bunch of stuff in here that I thought was of interest. We mentioned Ruby. So the .NET 2.0 SDK is for folks who are .NET developers. But if you're using other platforms, there's an SDK for each platform. And the real easy way to find out about that are the developer centers on WindowsAzure.com. It makes it really easy, no matter which developer technology you're using, to just come in, find all the documentation you need, all the downloads you need to get started with your platform on top of Azure. So in infrastructure as a service, where you can run your own VMs, and specifically Linux VMs, it's no problem to run Ruby or Ruby on Rails type sites and applications in Azure. It's a lot easier, whereas before, infrastructure as a service, it really was kind of a Rube Goldberg machine, and I'm not going to lie to you, it wasn't easy to set up. I wouldn't recommend it for folks. But now what they've added just recently in the past couple weeks is an SDK for Ruby. It's an official SDK. It's on GitHub. It's open source. And if you're running your Ruby app in a Linux VM on Azure, this now gives you the ability to use Azure storage, the blobs, the tables, and the queues on the back end, as well as the service bus, and tap into that stuff with your Ruby code. So I thought that was kind of neat. The other thing, also not .NET related, is support for Python. Now, I believe this is added maybe a little bit more than a week or two ago, but in Azure websites, you can host a Django site up in Azure websites. You can basically fire it up and just have a Python website up and running with that. But also within cloud services, you can use Python 2 a lot easier. There's a Python SDK for Azure, and believe it or not, for Visual Studio. And this is what really impressed me the most, is you install this and Visual Studio is now an IDE for Python. And I'm not talking about Iron Python, if folks remember that. It was a version of Python based on .NET. This is the real Python. You can basically, once you install this, do a file, new project, you know, Python in Visual Studio, and you get an IntelliSense, debugging, and all that type of good stuff. And then it links you right in with a published project for Windows Azure, and you can publish it right up as a cloud service. So that, I was really impressed to see that as I went through the docs and look at that. Like I said, we don't have time to demo that, but if it's something that interests you, check it out. There's a whole bunch of other stuff we just don't have time for today that's in the .NET SDK itself. So definitely go check it out. And along with that, they also updated the Azure Training Kit, which has a lot of mostly .NET sample applications and demos that flex the muscles of all the different parts of the SDK. So that's also a good way to learn, get yourself up to speed with what's changed and what's new in this thing.
Yeah, there was a bunch of changes, I think, too, to all the PowerShell libraries and commandlets that they had previously released. I haven't gone through them yet myself, but it is pretty exciting to see some of that as well, because I used to do quite a bit of demos with PowerShell, because it makes it so easy to set up an environment, to script everything, and IT guys love it. So maybe in a future episode we'll be able to dive into that a little bit more as well. But I think for this episode we're out of time. Peter, I know you need to run as well, so we'll just have to wrap it up. But we'll be back shortly. We'll talk next with Andrew finishing up his project, and then we'll also dive further into some of the new stuff in a future episode. So for myself and Peter and Chris on the back end, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.